is 21-1517 Clear One v. Shore Acquisition Holdings. Mr. Phillips, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. If Shure is allowed to get away with its nondisclosure of Levitt and Gulbranson in this case, then the duty of disclosure in AIA trials means nothing. Shure had both references during the IPR. The only questions are whether each was material at the times when the motions to amend were filed. And they are. Nothing else matters. Not Clear One's diligence, not Shure's intent, not any of the other irrelevant considerations that the board analyzed. Let's talk about intent. According to Shure, it made a self-serving unilateral decision with both references that they were not material. Is that the type of behavior we want the law to incentivize? No. Intent should have no role in the duty of disclosure analysis. The board's cases say that when a patent owner files a motion to amend, it is under an obligation to disclose all material information in its possession, period. Not just to disclose material information.
Mr. Phillips, I'm understanding you to be starting your argument with whether or not the board abuses discretion in denying the sanctions motion or denying your ability to even file a sanctions motion. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So what you're kind of addressing feels very much like the merits of whether you should prevail on a sanctions motion. Can you try to distinguish for me, the board in this case denied you the ability to even file one, which we review for abuse of discretion, and it gave a lot of different reasons.
Correct.
And some of them weren't really merits. Some of them were your motion appears to be identical to your prior rehearing motion in substance, which we already decided. That is not a merits-based reason, but rather, it seems to me, a discretionary sort of reason. Why don't you address that? Because it seems to me any one of those independent reasons they gave could be used to say they didn't abuse their discretion in doing it. So even if you were right on the materiality point, the board has discretion, and they gave at least four different reasons for why they were not going to allow you to file the motion itself. So why don't you try to start with, for example, the one I just raised, which is it appears as though your arguments in this motion were identical to the arguments you had raised in an earlier motion that they fully adjudicated.
Yes, we attempted to raise the same issue in our request for rehearing. And the board properly recognized that this failure to disclose the references is not a rehearable issue. We were trying to fit a round peg in a square hole. A square peg in a round hole. But that's not a reason to deny the sanctions motion. The standard for rehearing is extremely high. We didn't meet that standard.
You think the standard for sanctions is less high?
It's
really
a different standard. It is also high,
less
certainly.
High? What are the two different standards, precisely?
For rehearing, you have to show that the board misapprehended or overlooked some item of consequence. And they didn't in this case because Gulbranson and Levitt weren't disclosed. They weren't in the trial. They weren't overlooked or misapprehended. For sanctions, we have to show that the references were in the possession of the patent owner. We did. That they're material, and they are non-cumulatively material. And that should be the end of the inquiry.
Not true. The board has discretion to award sanctions. They have discretion to decide whether to even let you file a motion to award sanctions. And when they have that discretion, they can choose for a whole host of reasons beyond what you just said, even if there appears to be merit that sanctions aren't warranted in this case. Like in this case where they suggested that there was some bad action on both sides. That's a reason in lots of cases, for example, attorney's fees are denied, even though there is in fact a prevailing party.
Yeah, let me address that. The board thought that we were taking a second bite at the apple by raising the sanctions issue. We were not. We won the IPR. Clear One is thrilled with the condition of the 493 patent, wounded as it is. That is not why we are here. We did not need to or want to take a second bite at the apple in terms of the patentability here. But we were shocked and appalled that Shure did not disclose these references in the IPR, but then used them offensively as a weapon in the PGR. And
wow.
You really think
shocked and appalled are the exactly right adjectives to throw at a scenario like this. There's a lot of stuff in the world that I'm shocked and appalled at. This behavior, even as alleged, doesn't really come close to something like that for me. You must live a really great life. Go ahead, keep going.
Well, I will add, Your Honor, that there is a bad history between these parties. And from Clear One's perspective, there's a history and a pattern of bad behavior by Shure. And you, Judge Moore, you may have seen some of that from the last appeal that was up at this court from a contempt hearing or a contempt ruling in the district court. And this was a tipping point for Clear One. And so it wasn't gamesmanship to say, hey, there's a duty of disclosure. You had these references. You didn't disclose them. You should have disclosed them. There should be some penalty for that. We didn't get a fair trial because you withheld these references. That's not gamesmanship. That's just, you know, calling a spade and asking
for
fairness.
Sure, but I mean, you took your shot with the board. They disagreed. Your standard of review here is incredibly high. We rarely impose sanctions in any kind of case, and why do you think we would find that the board abused its vast degree of discretion here? I'm a little baffled about why we're talking about this issue and not the other issue, frankly. But if you want to waste your argument time on this issue, you can. I think it's highly unlikely you're going to prevail on an abuse of discretion on what seems like typical litigation posturing.
I do want to address the definiteness issue, certainly. But let me just say in response to your concern that abuse of discretion occurs when there is a legal error. Applying the wrong evidentiary standard, the wrong materiality definition is a legal error. Abuse of discretion occurs when there is not substantial evidence to support a materiality or cumulativeness of determination. And
you have to win on all of those.
I agree.
There are at least four separate reasons that the PTO articulated for why it wasn't going to allow you to file a sanctions motion. And I'm going to be honest, I think some of your arguments are frivolous. For example, the preponderance of the evidence versus the clear and convincing evidence one. I thought that argument was pretty close to frivolous. And you have to win on all four of them under an abuse of discretion standard. Continue to use your time as you wish.
Okay. I will turn to the indefiniteness issue, Your Honor. The phrase in question is arranged in a self-similar configuration. And there are a number of unanswered questions, such as how could Clear One or any member of the public design around this limitation? What is an arrangement of microphones that is not self-similar? What are the meets and bounds of this term? The specification does not answer those questions in this case. The dictionary definitions that the board cited do not answer those questions in this case. And those are really important questions for Clear One. Even though we don't care so much about the claims of this 493 patent, there are continuation applications that have been filed. There are foreign counterparts throughout the world. This problematic language can be perpetuated in many other patents. And Clear One ought to be able to determine, is its arrangement of microphones self-similar or not?
Well, let's assume that it's limited to the illustrations in the specification. Would your argument be any different?
If that's the meets and bounds of the phrase and nothing more, we wouldn't have an argument. Clear One would be able to go about its business, and the public would be able to determine whether an arrangement is the same or not, self-similar or not. But that's not Shure's position. Shure has been very clear that those are just two examples, in their view, of what is a self-similar arrangement. And we don't know, look at figure 5, for example. We don't know what aspect of figure 5 is self-similar to what other aspect or why. Sure hasn't told us. Sure has told us that the size of the rings can be different, the number of the microphones in the rings can be different, the rotational offset of the rings can be different.
But the geometric pattern cannot be.
Not so sure. I mean, the patent mentions oval shapes. I don't know if that's self-similar enough to circles or not. We don't
really
know.
Sounds like an infringement question. Sounds like something a jury could easily figure out.
Perhaps, but this is an indefiniteness issue, and there are so many different aspects of similarity that can be varied from pattern to pattern. It's a question that should be resolved with clear language. And the dictionary definitions do not help. Neither party embraced the definitions in the dictionaries.
But the board looked at the dictionaries, and then the board issued an order that invited the parties to expressly address these dictionary definitions and to proffer its own dictionary definitions if it had alternatives. Did you do that?
We did not. We repeated
so
our
don't
argument.
Don't complain about the board looking at dictionary definitions when it actually gave you a chance to offer any argument you have against them as well as your own competing definitions.
And the argument we offer is that the clarity has to come from the specification. Self-similar is a term of degree. So is similar. The word similar has a dictionary definition. But that doesn't mean that it's definite in every patent. The patent specification or somewhere in the intrinsic evidence has to provide the standard to know how much similarity is enough to be self-similar. And in this case, even what type of similarity are we talking about? And the specification does not answer those questions. This is indefinite language. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are other questions, Your Honors.
Sure, Mr. Phillips. No problem.
Thank you.
Mr. Schaffner, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joe Schaffner on behalf of Appalachia Shore Acquisition Holdings. May it please the court. This appeal involves two simple issues. First, the board correctly determined that the term self-similar was definite based on its plain and ordinary dictionary definition. The board supported that finding by citing relevant dictionaries, by citing the patent, finding that the patent did not diverge from that plain and ordinary meaning, and even citing the testimony of ClearOne's own expert who used the same or similar language to describe what he said was the simplest meaning of the term.
Can I ask you, is figure 5 self-similar because it's all circles and they're just in different sizes?
Yes, it's because they use a repeating pattern, and that pattern is simply concentric circles.
So what if you had a pattern that was squares repeated over and over and over?
That would also be a repeated pattern.
What about a pattern that is 10 microphones in a row?
Just a line?
Yeah.
That would not be a repeating pattern. You need to have a repeating pattern, and the patent makes that clear. So, for example,
is not 11111 a repeating pattern?
I don't think a line would be a repeating pattern.
But that's probably an infringement question.
That's an infringement question because we're no longer
talking. Or at least a claim construction question. Whether a pattern could include just one microphone.
Certainly, I think that might be a question. Yes.
So, where do you draw the line of between the various shapes that Judge Hughes has mentioned? For instance, how does one know where it's safe to have the same microphones and when it's not?
So again, the patent makes clear, Your Honor, that what matters is the shape of the arrangement. It's the shape. So if you don't have a patterned shape, then you don't fall within the scope of that.
The claim doesn't say the shape.
But that it does insofar as it says the microphones are arranged in a self-similar configuration. There was no dispute at trial that what the arrangement and configuration were shapes. Again, that's what their own expert said at paragraph 157 of his declaration at appendix 3835. He said what self-similar means is that something that has the same shape.
So you're telling us that the claims are sufficiently explicitly limited in view of the specification to a circular shape?
Yes, and the plain meaning of the term. Because, again, the board found that the dictionary definitions for self-similar were things that were copies of themselves, That is a repeated pattern, to use the specifications language.
But that means the micro... I assume that meant that the microphones were similar to each other. That's incorrect?
I don't know. It's not the that the microphones are similar to each other, Your Honor. It's that the shape that the microphones make...
And what is the shape similar to?
It has to be the same. It's not similar to anything else.
Concentric,
it has to be the...
concentric nested rings.
Yes, there. That would fit.
Self-similar is, in your intention, limited to concentric circles?
It's not limited to concentric circles, and we know that again from the specification. If you go to column 12, it says that we're not, that the similar shapes here don't have to be circles. They could be ovals, rectangles, squares, but it has to be a repeating pattern. The exact shape that you subtend is not important.
But we need to know, we're construing the claims, we need to know what's limited. We know that it's not new to put microphones in the ceiling. We know that it's not new to have multiple microphones. So where is the invention for your client?
Well, this self-similar term I don't think was actually a term that was used to define the novelty of the claim, but for the purpose of defining the scope of the claim, it would simply be, do you have a repeating pattern? That's the question. If you just have one circle, that's not a repeating pattern. If you have a circle and a square, that's not a repeating pattern. If you have concentric rings, now you do have a repeating pattern because you have multiple rings emanating out from the central point.
So you say there has to be more than one ring and they must be concentric.
Well, I think, in that example, yes. But again, we wouldn't be limited just to rings. But in an example where rings or circles were used, you would have to have more than one ring.
If it's limited, that I'm trying to find the outer boundary. That's what this claim construction is all about.
So,
what's the boundary? Where does it stop?
So it stops where you no longer have a repeating pattern. So if you have just one circle, that's not a repeating pattern because nothing repeats.
What if in figure 5 you substituted a square for the outer ring and enclosed the rest of the circles in a square?
That probably, Your Honor, would not be a repeating pattern. If you had something like circle, 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 square, that would no longer be a repeating pattern.
But in your specification, the example, the picture on the front page is one circle.
I think there are several circles that are being subtended in figure 5 and 9.
Don't think so, one circle with microphones in it.
I'm not sure if on the figure of the patent, Your Honor. The examples that are used to describe what a self-similar arrangement are figures 5 and 9. And figures 5 and 9 show concentric rings of microphones. Oh, Your Honor, there are several microphones there. That has concentric rings. Everywhere that's the same as the figure on the front of the patent, Your Honor.
Yes, the microphones are all in one ring.
No, they're not in one ring.
Right? Isn't that what the microphone is?
There are two different, at least two different rings there. And everywhere where you see those little square holes, Your Honor, like 106B, those are all different microphones.
Actually, it looks like it. Lots and lots, not just two.
Yes,
it looks like,
excuse me, there are,
starts in the very beginning with a single microphone, then you've got a little circle of microphones,
right.
Then a bigger circle, then a bigger circle, then a bigger, it goes.
So there's a central microphone there, 106A, and then it emanates out from there, where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it looks like 7 concentric rings of microphones. So again, the specification makes clear that what you need is a...
I don't want to hypothetical you to doubt, but when you say self-similar patterns, does that mean you can only have one shape in the self-similar pattern, or can you have multiple shapes that repeat?
I would think that as long as you have multiple shapes that form a pattern, you could have multiple shapes. So for example...
So if you have triangle, square, or triangle, square repeated over and over again...
That would be a repeated pattern.
Okay.
Because it's a pattern that repeats. It's an AB, AB, AB pattern in that instance. And again, the board said that this claim was definite and this term was definite based on the plain and ordinary meaning of this term, read in the light of the specification, which did not deviate from that meaning, and it credited the testimony of Clear One's expert, who defined the term himself and then applied the term to the prior art in the same way that we're discussing today. In Appendix 1001 at the preliminary guidance stage, the board invited Clear One to submit countervailing evidence, to submit counterconstructions, and it did not do so. In both of its subsequent briefs submitted to the board, it did not mention the board's dictionary definitions, and it never took issue with them. So it was unsurprising for the board then to rely on those dictionary definitions when it found the claim term definite. I think wasn't mentioned today, but in the brief there was some question about what standard might apply, whether it's In Re Packet or Nautilus. I think that issue is very simple here, which is that Clear One never mentioned Packard to
the
board.
Do you think in construing this claim or deciding whether it's definite or not, that we can decide it's definite based solely on the intrinsic record? I noted that the opinion below referred to expert testimony, it referred to dictionary definitions. Do you think we need to move to extrinsic evidence to resolve this? Certainly the extrinsic evidence doesn't hurt your case, right? The board found that all of that evidence supported the conclusion it was not definite. Do you think it can be done on the basis of the patent alone, or do you think it needs to be an analysis, a holistic analysis that includes everything?
Your Honor, I do think that the term is clear based solely on the intrinsic evidence, but that the extrinsic evidence just confirms exactly what the board found. That, again, if you can go to the specification in columns 3, 9, and 12, there the specification describes a self-similar arrangement as something like a fractal. That gets at this scale invariance, which is directly out of the board's dictionary definition. And then at columns 11 and 15, it describes the self-similar configuration as a repeating pattern, which is what we've been discussing so far. That's what the board said was a copy of itself coming right from the dictionary definition. And again, it supported that finding with the testimony of Clear One's expert, and that needs to be given substantial evidence deference.
All right, so rectangular shapes, for instance, or something with multiple angles would be self-similar.
If you had the same...
In your view.
Yes, Your Honor. If you had the same polygon, because that's the word that comes out of the specification in column 12. If you have the same polygon repeated over and over again, that's a repeating pattern.
So as long as it's sufficiently symmetrical, no matter how many sides to the shape or whatever, even though there's no illustration in the specification of anything other than concentric circles?
Yes.
How do we know it would work in rectangular shape?
Well, because I think it's fairly easy to envision a rectangular shape emanating out from a central point, just the way that you would have a circle.
Well, wouldn't your answer to Judge Newman actually be in column 12, the patent expressly says it can be ovals, squares, rectangles,
yes,
triangles, pentagons, or other polygons, that just has to be a series of them?
Exactly.
So, right, so it's the specification itself says this will work with any of those kinds of shapes, just so long as it's a repeated pattern of arrays of microphones.
Precisely.
Okay.
That's precisely.
And so if it should turn out that it doesn't work with whatever kind of exotic polygon someone creates, that destroys your patent or what?
That's
the
question.
Are you saying we just claim what works?
That's a question of infringement, Your Honor. We'd have to see what that shape looks like. If it were a repeated shape, it would seem to fall right within the scope of the claim because due to column 12. But if you don't have a repeated shape, if you've made a shape that can't be repeated somehow, it's difficult to imagine what that would look like, then that wouldn't fall within the scope of the claim.
So we're saying whatever shape you select, if it works, it infringes. If it doesn't work, it doesn't infringe.
It has nothing to do with whether it works, Your Honor. It's whether the shape is repeating. It has a repeating pattern or not. It doesn't matter what the shape is.
But that's not really what the role is of the specification. Is it to invite to go out and test my invention? It's to be explicit as to what you've discovered and what you're entitled to.
And what the patent says here is that when you have a repeated pattern of microphones, there are actually several technical advantages to that, and it uses, for example, the concentric rings as an example.
But does it say that when you look at the drawings? The drawings are all concentric circles.
And the patent explains, for example, why you might want to use different numbers of microphones and different numbers of in different levels of different rings. The patent explains why you do that. Again, the patent is not limited... expressly not limited to concentric rings. It says you can use any shape, and it's not just depending on what works. It's the question, that's an infringement question almost. The scope of the claim is, do you have a repeated pattern or not? Did you have the same shape or not?
And so if somebody wants to design around this, they just don't have repeated patterns.
Just don't have a repeated pattern, Your Honor, and then you don't have a self-similar configuration. All you need to do is not have a repeating
pattern. Just take a couple microphones and put them in a slightly different pattern.
Yes.
Just a few of the array.
Yes.
That's it.
Yes.
And boom, you're out.
The last issue I'd like to address today is the issue of sanctions. I think the court has a pretty good handle on this situation. The sole basis for...
The only part I found a little difficult with the sanctions motion is the board seemed to blend into its decision questions that related to whether to grant the motion, along with questions that seemed to be more focused on the merits of the motion. It's like, okay, we're not going to let you file a motion because we've prejudged in some respects. Now, not all of it is a matter of prejudging. I think some of their rationales were this is identical to the motion you already filed and we've already decided, and that's independent. But I'm just confused. What is the standard that the board should apply when deciding whether to allow someone to file a motion, separate and apart from whether the motion should prevail, but whether to allow someone to file a motion?
Again, this is a highly deferential discretionary standard, and so it seems to me that what would have to be alleged would something that, if proven true, would rise to the level of sanctionable conduct. And here, the board found that we were nowhere even close to that. It said so for several different reasons. It said, first, because Clear One did file a virtually identical motion a month ago, we don't have to guess as to what the merits of its motion is. We have it chapter and verse. We can look at this now because we effectively do have their sanctions motion. And what the board said was, we're not going to grant this motion for several independent reasons. First, the references are cumulative to what everything that's in the record, some of them as much as 8 references of record. Second, the board said, Shore had no ill intent, and that's undisputed. Shore had no intent to do anything wrong, and so we wouldn't grant you your motion anyway because it's undisputed that they had no intent, and intent is required by the rule. Third, it said, we're going to, as Your Honor has stated, we, for equitable reasons and for discretionary reasons, aren't going to allow you to do this. It's going to multiply proceedings. We think that this is a thinly veiled attempt at the second bite of the apple. You waited until after we filed our final written decision and then tailored your sanctions decision to try to undo and salvage the issue that you lost at trial. We're not going to allow this for efficiency reasons, and we see no merit to your sanctions motion anyway. So to answer your question, Your Honor, what standard should apply? It would have to be conduct that seems that, if it were true, would rise to the level of sanctionable conduct. And the board said that is not the case here for facts, law, and equity.
And we'd have to decide that every one of those independent reasons was an abuse of discretion.
And not only that, on undisputed facts. They haven't challenged that Graham does teach us on premiable screen. They haven't challenged that 8 other references teach a side rail limitation. They've challenged none of that. They don't challenge that we lacked any ill intent. So not only is it an abuse of discretion, Your Honor, it's on undisputed facts, which is why, again, the evidentiary standard does not matter, because the facts are undisputed.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Schaffner. Mr. Phillips, you have some rebuttal time.
Turning back to the indefiniteness issue, there's nothing new about arranging microphones in concentric rings. There are many, many prior art references that do that. If you look at appendix pages 171 through 75.
Well, it seems like it's a really broad definition that might be obvious, but it doesn't seem indefinite.
Well, let me be clear. Dr. Begald, our expert witness, never provided a definition of self-similar. He said it might include this notion, it may include that notion. He had an estimate for what it might mean, but he never provided a definition. And here today, we've heard that what self-similar means, apparently, is just simply a repeating pattern. But that's not what the dictionary definitions say. There are 2 different definitions, and they're not the same. One says an exact copy of itself. The other says a copy that is similar. Well, how much similarity? According to Shure, a ring with 21 microphones is self-similar to one with 7. And the final point I'll make here is that if it's as simple as a repeating pattern, there's clear language to say so. Self-similar is an awkward fit for that meaning. And imagine just a random scatterplot arrangement of microphones. You can draw a circle over here around 3 microphones. It's a mathematical fact. You can.
Sounds like you're talking infringement.
And another one over here. You have, is it self-similar or not?
That's an infringement question.
But if you can't tell what's similar, it's indefinite. Unless there are further questions, that's all I have.
Okay, and thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission.